I open up the House Energy and Environment Committee, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill. Actually, we are going to start with 2251. And I'd like to ask Luis Soliday to come up from Department of State Lands and give an overview of the bill. Do you want to say anything about the bill?
Oh.
Okay. I guess she's pointing at Kevin and Patrick. Good afternoon, gentlemen, and I apologize, I don't know where the rest of my committee is, but we have a quorum, so we're going to get started. It's tough being the lunch follow-up crowd here.
We'll try to keep it live.
Go take naps or something afterwards.
Chair Ding, fellow members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen, and I manage the state's Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Kevin Moynihan from Department of State Lands is going to talk about the substance of what's in the bill in front of you. I'm going to give you just a quick couple of minutes of some how did we get here and why are we here and what is this windup. As you know, the system if you're, of permits, if someone's going to pursue a project that involves wetlands appropriately, has high standards for protecting Oregon's natural resource values. The system itself can be fairly daunting and complex. Someone who wants to do a removal fill project will go to the Department of State Lands to make application. The department will provide an opportunity to other state agencies to comment. Those agencies will comment, often requiring subsequent permits, and so an applicant can be faced with a circumstance of needing to deal with the Department of State Lands, deal later with other agencies, have changes come up in a project due to comments of the other agency, have to go back to the Department of State Lands. And there's been, not surprisingly, a lot of angst by applicants over a long period of time with this system. Overlay on that the fact that there's federal permitting through the Corps of Engineers, as well in many cases as local permitting, and you get a fairly complex system that applicants have to deal with. There have been a number of attempts legislatively in past sessions to deal with the federal and state overlap that have not been successful for a variety of reasons, and into that, and last session was no exception. We had a bill to deal with that was not able to move. In that environment, my office, the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, was asked by the Governor's Natural Resources Cabinet to work with this collection of agencies to find real quickly, were there some things we knew right off the bat that we could do to make that system work better? And we came up with, and I think you have at the table now in front of you, a May 5th report that was a set of about three dozen recommendations that a task force of agencies we assembled came up with to say, what can we start doing right away that we can make this system work better? As we did that work, we elected, because of the legislative history, to set aside the issue of federal permitting and state permitting and focus solely on what is it that state agencies do and what is it that state agencies themselves control. Let's get our own house in order and get the system that we control and operate running as effectively as we possibly can before we try to argue that we've got the credibility to deal with these other issues related to other layers of government. The 33rd recommendation in that list that is in this May 5th report was to reflect on the fact that this isn't a system of permits that anybody set down and designed from the top down to look the way it looks today. It's an aggregation of things that have happened over a period of time. We started with one permit, and legislative negotiations being what they often are, you make a decision of where to put a piece of regulation based on what are the factors on the ground and in the agencies at the time. Another piece comes in, you make a different set of decisions at that point, and you have the system that's diffuse across a bunch of agencies. So nobody would build it the way it exists today. So we said, what would we design a system to look like if we were able to actually design it from the ground up? And that's really what the bill today proposes to deal with. It's a pilot project to let us significantly change the way removal fill permits are done in Oregon, to provide a couple of things. Much better information to applicants up front at the time that they're doing an application so they know what they have to do to comply if they can get a permit. And secondly, rather than leaving these things that might come from other agencies as these unresolved problems that sit out there as sort of traps that crop up at the 11th hour, how to get those problems resolved much earlier in the process so there's not rework and redesign and surprises as someone is trying to go through a project. We designed it as a pilot, frankly, rather than as simply a bill to give you a new system, because there's lots of concern by stakeholders all the way around these sets of issues about what would a new process look like versus the existing process, even if people don't necessarily like the existing process, the devil you know versus the devil you don't know, if you will. And so we decided the most effective way to deal with that was to authorize a pilot that applicants can opt into, that gives you a new system that that we can try out, see how it works, and then you all can consider at a later time whether that makes the most sense. And so unless there are any questions you might have for me, I'd turn it over to Kevin to talk about what's in the bill and what the pilot looks like.
Go ahead, Kevin. Thank you.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Moynihan, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands, Wetland and Waterway Conservation Division. I'm here this afternoon to testify in support of House Bill 2251, the water-related permit process improvement team, known colloquially as the RIPET bill. It's a streamlining bill related primarily to the Department of State Lands removal fill program. As Pat Allen stated, House Bill 2251 allows a number of state agencies to create a pilot project for processing water-related permits. The Department of State Lands has been designated the lead agency for this process, as many of the water-related permits have to come to DSL for a removal fill permit authorization as part of the permitted activity. Under the pilot, DSL's removal fill application process will be the doorway for applicants seeking not only removal fill permit, but also certain other state agency authorizations. This includes authorizations, for example, for fish passage, state in-water blasting permits, scientific take permits, incidental take permits, surface mine operating permits, and ocean shore permits. There are a total of 11 potential state agency authorizations that could be garnered through this RIPET DSL removal fill related permit process. Some of the highlights of the process are there'll be one application with one approval process with a lead agency, DSL, being the lead regulatory agency from the beginning to the end of the process. There'll be one predictable and concurrent timeline rather than multiple different agency timelines involved with the process. We'll have a one-stop shop through Department of State Lands with specialized assistance. There'll be one set of consistent requirements for applicants to design around and implement as part of their water-related permit project. More specifically, the pilot would include DSL will provide early information to the applicant on the range of state agency permits that may be required as part of the project. There'll be early guidance available from Department of State Lands, allowing a project proponent to, again, design a project around all the different state authorizations that may be required as part of the process. DSL will ensure pre-application meeting quality early on in the process, including mandatory involvement by participating state agencies as part of that pre-application review. In other words, identification of different state agency requirements early on in the process, and then continued involvement with one lead agency, one lead staff person, Department of State Lands, guiding the applicant through the process, not only with Department of State Lands, but with the other participating state agencies. DSL will manage this process with one application packet involving many of the other state agency requirements. There will be some separate application requirements that will still exist. For example, DEQ erosion control permits and water quality certifications, Department of Land Conservation and Development Coastal Zone Management Act consistency certifications, and most of the Department of Water Resources water use authorizations. These separate state agency authorizations could not be bundled into this water-related permit process improvement team application process. However, the applicants that come in through this process will have any additional still separate state agency requirements identified early on in the process and will continue to guide the applicant if they need to through the process of obtaining whatever those additional state requirements may be. So we've attempted to bundle as many of the state authorizations as we can. Again, it could be up to 11 separate state authorizations, could be bundled into the Department of State Lands removal fill permit process. However, there are still a few others that are out there that cannot be brought into the process, but we will provide identification and guidance to the applicant concerning those. The removal fill permit issued by the Department of State Lands will integrate as many of those multiple state agency regulatory requirements into that permit as possible. With Department of State Lands as a lead, we've already set up and will continue to work through a pilot management team, which includes Department of State Lands and the six other state agencies who are participatory in this process. There's been quite a bit of outreach already by the RIPET team with the public and stakeholders. They've issued 8,300 brochures to the public identifying different water-related permit applications that may be required as part of a project activity in state waters. We've developed a comprehensive user guide for water-related permit application process that's now published on Department of State Lands and the other agencies' websites that's available for the public to look at and begin to work through and design their application to get through the process. Some more specifics on House Bill 2251. DSL would be granted authority by rule to set up a separate statutory time frame for the process of these applications, different from the current statutory timeline of 120 days for processing of the standard removal fill application. The RIPET team has determined that it could take up to 150 days, an additional 30 days, to bundle in the other separate state agency process into the department's removal fill permit process. So for another 30 days, though, the applicant has the efficiency still of not having to go to several other state agencies with different timelines to get their permits. So there still is an efficiency built into that. So by rule, the department could extend the statutory timeline. Where we are right now is by the end of 2006, all of the agencies who are participating, including Department of State Lands, had entered into a memorandum of agreement which sets forth in detail what each agency's specific responsibilities would be under the RIPET process to assist applicants in working through water-related permit applications. The application for the RIPET process is voluntary. The department anticipates we could handle up to 50 applications a year under the process, under the pilot process. We do have an associated program option package, would include the funding for one additional FTE, which would be a high-level natural resource specialist four in Department of State Lands, who would be the point person in our agency for this particular process to guide applicants through. The RIPET process, the pilot, is one of several streamlining processes that the Department of State Lands is currently working on to assist applicants through while at the same time protecting our natural resources. With that said, I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, I'll take questions from the committee. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. In sub 5, participation in the program by an applicant for a removal fill permit is voluntary. The state agencies participating in the program may limit the number of applicants that are eligible to participate in the program. Explain the purpose of the last sentence for me.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, it is a pilot project, so we want to try to limit the number of applicants, if only because we'll have limited staff resources to guide these applications in a qualitative way through the process. If the pilot works as is intended to, the intent would be to expand the number of applications and handle as many as we actually could. But through the initial run-through in the process, we feel that we would have adequate staff to handle up to approximately 50 applications.
Follow-up.
Representative Jensen.
Further clarification, Madam Chair. I understand or can understand that, but why the plural of state of agency there? If you were saying the agency, may limit the number of applicants that are eligible to participate, I would understand that. But I'm not sure why the other state agencies are going to be...
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, I take your point on that. I'm not sure that we couldn't easily resolve that. Again, Department of State Lands will be the portal that's guiding applicants through the process. So the intent of this, I believe, is to cover the department, the one Department of State Lands.
I see a nervous director in the back of the room. No?
Okay.
And just to pick up on that.
I appreciate that. I just think, Madam Chair, that there's more clarity this is a DSL's pilot program, and I don't see any other agencies that may be, and if they are, or if they might feel they are, I'm sure a conversation with DSL as to the reasons might be more than sufficient to resolving those conflicts. But
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, if I could add on to that, because this is a participatory process with other state agencies, we have set up a pilot management team, which includes not only the Department of State Lands, but these other six agencies as well. The pilot management team is the team that actually will run the process and determine what the appropriate number of applications to come through may be. The reality is, though, that it is the Department of State Lands who's going to be actually limiting the number of applications through the process. So we'll take a look at the wording on that and determine what's the most appropriate language.
It just strikes me that a state agency might... I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I'm going to follow up.
A state agency, where the management team that you've got may not be in agreement, but a state agency by this wording might be able to subvert whatever the intention of the pilot program might be on a particular case. And it's nothing I'm going to fall on my sword over, but I would like a little more clarity, I guess, personally.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, if I could say on that particular issue, though, all of the other state agencies, including Department of State Lands, are committed to this process. So we haven't received any pushback or non-cooperation from the other agencies. They're on board with this.
Okay, thank you.
Good. I'd like to applaud the agency for coming forth with issues of this nature. With process of this nature, one thing that we would like to do is expedite in any way we can these issues when they appear before us in state agencies, and this looks like a significantly good step in that direction. I'll be interested in following it. So.
Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, I'll direct it to the two of you if you decide who should respond. The existing removal fill permitting process, to what extent is it supported by the fees that the people seeking the permits pay to the department?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, these will not be additional applications on top of the applications we already have coming into the agency. And again, there's no specific fee tied into voluntary participation in this program. So that throws us back on to the fees that we have, the removal fill program, and whether they're sufficient to support the program, which is part of our application, House Bill 2105, to increase the removal fill fees. Currently, the Common School Fund is subsidizing the removal fill regulatory program to approximately 90% of the revenues that are required to fund the program. this particular RIPET process doesn't impact that directly one way or the other. Again, these are applications that would likely come into Department of State Lands anyway. It's not adding to that number. It's just moving them into a different direction through hopefully an expedited process.
Follow up. There are some of us who believe that the application fee process should support the activity rather than having the common school fund in effect subsidizing this permitting process. And I'm just so that's obviously a policy choice being debated in connection with a separate bill. But what I'm seeing in this bill is that it's designed for the convenience and reduction of cost for the applicants to make the process of complying simpler, faster, and cheaper. But I see a fiscal for the pilot program that is, you know, not a modest amount of money. And I'm just wondering, is there some mechanism for having those people who are choosing to engage in removal or fill activities with our state lands, shouldn't they be bearing that cost?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, that issue was discussed through the RIPET team process over the last 18 months. There was an intentional decision made not to seek an additional fee for the pilot project to see how it works and then to bring that back to the table and see whether it would be appropriate to increase a fee or create a fee to add for this particular application process. But clearly none currently exists in this proposal.
And Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, if I could add to that, as we went through this process, there are a lot of things that we think are true but can't necessarily play out, and we think that there are things that'll happen in this pilot that'll actually, without looking at fees, improve the efficiency and effectiveness and reduce the cost of administering the existing system. What I think hinted at it in my testimony, right now what will happen at times is someone will come to the Department of State Lands acting within that 120-day timeline, and the department will issue a permit contingent on a number of things, one of which is go to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and talk to them about fish passage or whatever the case might be. That department will look at it and say, okay, project, except you have to do this thing over here that changes the design of your project, which then causes the applicant to go back to the Department of State Lands to have to file for an amended permit and file all that material in a change. There's a huge amount of rework, not just for the applicant, but also for the agency. The agency has to touch that application multiple times, often by virtue of not having done something that's envisioned in the pilot and working those things out. And so we think, as Kevin says, that when we are able to come back at a point in the future after having operated this pilot, we'll be able to say things a lot more specifically about what do fees look like, what kinds of savings were we able to achieve in the system just by how we operate and those kinds of things.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Okay. Any other questions? Guy, before you leave, gentlemen, I have a couple of questions for you. One is, as far as community solutions team, I've been around long enough now, I remember the community solutions team. So tell me how this is different. I don't know if either of you or I call the director up, because I remember when we set those up, that was supposed to help facilitate coordination among the different agencies with specific projects. And I'm going to ask Louise to come up and see if she could address that. But you may want to stick around, because I have another couple of questions for you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. I think what we're trying to do is take a model the Community Solutions team worked with and actually codify it, institutionalize it as the way we do business. And for those of you who weren't around during the original Community Solutions team, there were five agencies that are originally a part of the Community Solutions team, and what they were doing was working with local communities on projects that they wanted to implement in their communities that involved one or more of those five agencies in the decision making. And they were the Department of Transportation, the Department of Land Conservation Development, the Department of Environmental Quality, Housing and Community Development, and I'm going to miss who the fifth original one.
Did you say?
I did say DEQ. it'll come to me. And since then, Department of State Lands has been added to it. Department of Agriculture has been added to it. We now have 8 agencies that are on what's called the Economic Revitalization Team these days. And that group still works with communities on their projects, but I think it has a broader mission, as did the Community Solutions Team, and goes beyond just the natural resource permitting aspect and how do you connect the transportation components to development projects that are going on in local communities, the land use decisions that need to be made to implement those decisions. So I think there's still a role and a very important role for the Economic Revitalization Team to play, as the Community Solutions Team did, that's broader than just this particular piece of a project.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. A couple other quick questions. One is, I know we have no control, direct control over the federal agencies, but in my personal experience, sometimes that is the biggest log jam in getting permits, is coordination with the federal agencies. So what discussions have you had, or what role can DSL play in negotiating with the federal agencies?
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think several of you are aware that we actually tried an experiment last year to fold in the federal authorizations into the Department of State Lands Removal Fill permit called the SPGP, or State Programmatic General Permit, which was a permit that the Corps of Engineers issued to the state of Oregon that allowed us, when we issued a state removal fill permit, to also provide authorization to do work under a Corps 404 under the Clean Water Act permit as well. And that included consultations with the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and coastal zone management consistency through DLCD and 401 certification from the Department of Environmental Quality. The permit did not work, did not streamline the process for anybody that we can tell, and as a result, we asked that permit be suspended. And part of what happened was we ended up with a stacked set of conditions instead of an integrated set of conditions from all of the federal agencies. We ended up requiring applicants to send in a lot more paperwork, some of which was needed and some of which was not in all cases. And so we have suspended that effort, and we are back at the table meeting with the Corps and the services and EPA to talk about how to redesign that effort in a way that is going to work. And I can tell you the direction we're now headed is looking at using general permit authorization, which we're going to seek as an amendment to House Bill 2105, to mirror what the Corps does in terms of general permits and nationwide permits, and go more to a process, either notification-based permitting or a general permit that covers a suite of activities in a geographic area or a programmatic group of projects. So we have a number of streamlining efforts we're continuing to work on, and we are continuing the efforts to try and streamline the federal authorizations with ours.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Mm-hmm. A couple other quick questions, and then we'll move on. We have another person who'd like to testify. One is, I'm a little concerned about the one FTE. I'm hearing one FTE, 50 applications. That seems like a pretty large workload. So one of the things, my understanding, this is to try to streamline, reduce workloads for the agencies. So can you maybe address that and how you came up with that number?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we looked at the number of applications that we currently have assigned to resource coordinators, which is in excess of 50. It's on the order of 60 to 70 to 80, depending on the resource coordinator, and determined that 50 would be a number that one resource coordinator at the NRS4, the higher staff level, could process appropriately, could spend adequate time up front in the process through pre-application, could consistently coordinate with the other state agencies involved in the process. We did a workload analysis and came up with one FTE equals 50 applications of this type.
Okay. And my final request is going to be if, and I haven't had a chance to look through this whole packet yet, and it may be in here, but I think what would be helpful for the committee is if, and I don't know if you could do this in a graphic, because I think if you could show some type of graphic of how the RIPET process would work versus our existing system. In other words, you know, you're going through sort of like this, and and working with all the different agencies. Is that in here?
Madam Chair, yeah. We have one of those. It's not included in the report, and we'll get it to the committee.
And then show how this, through a streamlined process or where you have one-stop shopping, how that would be different when you're going to DEQ for a 401 certification or ODFMW for, you know, an in-water work permit, how that would be different through the RIPET process versus the existing process. I think that would be helpful.
Right. Now, we'll certainly do that. It's worth knowing going in that schematically, because part of what we're doing is getting a lot of issues worked out earlier in the process between agencies. Schematically, that does not necessarily look simpler, although the end result is fewer do loops for the applicant as they move through agencies. So when we provide that to you, you shouldn't expect to see something that had a bunch of boxes and lines and has fewer boxes and lines in some respects. It has more because the agencies are basically taking responsibility for doing work that they used to put off on the applicant and make them go do. So
well, and a follow-up to that could be maybe just an overall timeline with the existing process versus a timeline with the RIPET process. I'm not saying, we're going to skip these steps. It's how the process will be different from what the existing process is. Because for some of the committee members who have never had the pleasure of going through the wetland fill process, that may be something helpful for them to understand. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. And the only other person we have signed up to testify is Mel Stewart. Is there anyone else that would like to testify at this time? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Committee members, also, you should have a testimony that was submitted previously from the Oregon Home Builders Association on this bill, and I think that was handed out last week. You can go ahead and start, Mr.
Stewart. I'll just wait for just a minute to the paperwork, because I'm going to be just addressing some of the things that are currently in statute.
And for the record, can you state your name, please?
Absolutely. My name is Mel Stewart, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I listened to the discussion there, and I think that they all sounded like very, very good ideas. The problem with them is that I've heard them all before. In 1973, there was a proposition before the Oregon legislature called Senate Bill 100, which created our statewide land use planning. And I've given you a copy of the existing statute that makes those same representations about the coordination between state agencies and local government and how that was to take place. I'd like to draw your attention to the legislative findings in there, and I've highlighted the pertinent section. But under statewide land use planning, state agencies were going to be responsible for, at the time of either acknowledgement or periodic review, making sure that their needs were met in the existing comprehensive plan. So that when a property owner like myself went out to buy a piece of property to build residential housing, that he could reasonably expect that the needs of the state agencies, Department of Fisheries, Division of State Lands, that all those things had been addressed within that comprehensive plan. And that if that comprehensive plan zoned a piece of property for residential housing, low-income housing, that I could be reasonably safe in buying that piece of property to build that low-income housing, and that I wouldn't have a state agency stepping in years after the fact just to say, no, we're not going to permit you to build the residential housing that the comprehensive plan assured me that I could build in the first place. And in this current bill, you're centralizing power in the Division of State Lands. In Senate Bill 100, as I pointed out in ORS 190-1005, the ultimate decision maker was going to be the local government, the city or the county. And they could only make that decision after they had sought compliance and periodic review with all the needs of the state agencies. Now, in many cases, what's taken place here is the state agency, such as the Division of State Lands, has not participated in periodic review. Therefore, their needs don't get met, and they step in at the permit process after expensive infrastructure, road, street, water, sewer have already been put in the ground, after all functional values of the wetlands have already been obliterated, and then they stop it at the permit stage. It makes no sense, and it's an expensive process. I would have liked to have seen what the original intent of Senate Bill 100 being fully implemented at that point in time, so that you had a surety right from the point in time when you purchased the piece of property. I suspect you put in maybe $500 million to put, you know, your statewide planning, land use planning scheme, and it looks like it hasn't particularly worked out well at this point in time. I think engaging on another coordination scheme when the last one fared so poorly is questionable. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. Are there any comments from Mr. Stewart?
One more thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a statutory common school fund. There's just one common school fund. I did a search of all statutes of the Constitution. There is just one common school fund, and all the money for this regulatory program is coming out of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else would like to testify in this bill before we close the public hearing? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2251. And I'm now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2294, and this is relating to fish screening. Kat, would you like to tell us about that? Okay, we're going to defer to ODFW, I think, is here. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I guess, Roy, we're going to defer to you to give us an excellent overview on this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Thank you,
Madam
Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to appear here today on House Bill 2294. On my right, Mr. Ray Harder-Road. He is the program manager for our fish screening and passage program, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And in addition to our written testimony, which you have in front of you, I've also started at either end some very good photographs of a wide array of fish screening projects, from small to large, all with surface water diversions, rotary drums, vertical screens, everything from 1 cubic feet per second to over 1,000 cubic feet per second. And so I want to just cover testimony here and then go right to questions. I think I've had a chance to meet with most of you regarding this legislation. Again, House Bill 2294. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Fish Screening Passage Program has a long history, the last 15 years, or actually quite a few years before then, working cooperatively with agricultural, municipal, and industrial water users in providing fish screening at water diversions and fish passage at dams. During 16 years since the inception of this cost-share program in 1991, the program has participated in 915 fish screening and 49 fish passage projects. And these have ranged, again, as I said, and from the photographs all the way from less than one CFS, which are primarily, as we talked about before, Representative McPherson pump screens at the end of a pump just stuck into a creek or river, to very large water diversion projects of over 1,000 more CFS. And in fact, Madam Chair, one of the things, if the committee does have time and wishes to go view some local fish screening and passage projects, one of the pictures you'll see is the Santiam Water Control District structure, which is a real high technological piece of work that we worked on with Santiam Water Control District. The department, in fact, even before it was the Fish and Wildlife Department, when it was the Game Commission, had a history of fish screening projects, and particularly in the 40s and 50s in eastern Oregon, did a lot of work in a lot of small water diversions that presently now were cut off by Hell's Canyon Dam. But we've had a fish screening shop, or fish screening kind of fabrication shop in the John Day area since early 1950s. Back in about 1989, however, and a lot of this discussion of decreasing salmon numbers led the 1989 legislature to request that ODFW review the problem of juvenile fish mortality at unscreened water diversions and establish guidelines for determining the need for and location of potential fish screening and bypass devices. We produced a report, the agency did, called an inventory of water diversions in Oregon needing fish screens, that established that there are over 55,000 water diversions in the state, many of which were unscreened at the time and had potential to kill many, many young fish. In 91, the legislature then, with the work of agriculture, sport fishing, water user groups, helped ODFMW develop a pilot program that was later made permanent in 1995. It was designed essentially, again, it's probably one of the most successful landowner programs in Oregon state government, and it works very simply. It's a 60-40 cost share where somebody that needs a fish screening device, whether it's a pump screen, a larger screen, whatever, under cubic feet, 30 cubic feet per second, generally can come and apply with the department for the department to defray 60% of the total cost of the installation. And that person then is responsible for the other 40%, and that can be in-kind or in-cash. There are also significant, the current statutes also establish certain levels about how much money will be used on the 60-40 and what's the total cost share amount allowed to be. I guess to sum up where the program is right now and the revisions we have in front of you, Madam Chair, back in 1991 when the pilot program was put into account or into effect, the resources dedicated to this kind of work were much more limited than they are today. And so because there were very specific statute, very specifically in statute created as to amounts of money per user or 60-40 or however it was going to be used, I think you've seen now today, now that we have put in quite a bit more state money per biennium than we ever did back in the early 90s, differences in state money went from a few hundred thousand a biennium in state money to now $4, $5, or $6 million today, which most of it is OWEB money. That has really allowed the department to do a lot more work with fish screening applicants of all sizes. I've covered on page 2 and then on page 3 really what the highlights of proposed revisions of the current statutes are. We'd like to be able to, instead of using just a rote number of a goal of 150 diversions per biennium, like to have the statutes be more creative or more flexible, allow us to measure that either in numbers diversions or cubic feet per second screened of 150. We'd like authorizations in the statute so it's clear that we can cost share with diversions of any size. We'd also like to clarify the cost sharing to allow flexibility in the actual amounts of funds allowed for cost share to the water user, and make sure that correctly under the statutes, the department is allowed the flexibility to use the increased funding that has now available. We'd also like to charge the actual cost of inspection and minor maintenance and consolidate some other mostly redundant statutes currently on the books. I know there's a number of people wanting to testify, Madam Chair. I guess I would be open to questions at this time, Ray and I both.
Okay. Are there any questions for this panel? Okay, I have a quick question for you before we move on. In your testimony, you state that the proposed goal is 150 diversions or 100 CFS screened per biennium.
150 CFS, Madam Chair.
150 CSF. So that's a big difference. I mean, couldn't you have one diversion that's a big CFS?
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. Right now, That's exactly the issue. So when the agency does some larger screens, some smaller screens, as for the statutory goal, they all count as one screen. So when you see the pictures that you're going to see pictures from a small pump screen to mm-hmm. a huge thousand, well, that all counts as one under the statute. And so we wanted some flexibility to reflect if we're going to be looking to measure success of the program, you need to measure it kind of an apples to apples way, which is you're really looking at the amount of the volume. One of the measures is the total volume of water you're protecting for losing fish in versus just building a pump screen or building a rotary drum screen or like that. So there is a big difference in the two, which is exactly right.
And then how are you going to balance right now the bulk of the program goes to smaller diversions, so how are you going to balance between the larger and the smaller diversions under the new program, the proposed program?
Well, Madam Chair, and I asked Ray for some numbers on this. Since 99, when we first received Measure 66 funds, 70% of the total project funding has been used for projects under 30 cubic feet per second. And when I talked to the Fish Green staff about this earlier, a couple of days ago, they point out to me that in their recollection, the agency had never turned down an under 30 CFS project, where they have turned down quite a few over 30 CFS projects for a number of reasons. I think one of the checks and balances in the system, and you'll hear from Mr. Brad Staples in a little bit, who's the chair of the Fish Greening Task Force. It's a public advisory group put in the law to advise the department on how to proceed on fish greening projects and policy. That is made up of a mix of a certain number of agricultural seats, a certain number of sport fishing seats, and a member of the public at large. And so they usually meet quarterly, and it's been really, I think in some ways, because what has made this program so successful is that because we have a kind of public advisory body made up of folks who are focused in on the program and are very interested in the program, it's been a way for the agency to make sure it's serving the needs of the irrigation and fishing communities. And so you may want to talk to Mr. Staples when he comes up, but my sense would be to keep the balance we need and to make sure we hit as many small water diversions as we can. I think it's that interaction with the Fish Greening Task Force that has helped the agency stay right on this issue. And so I think that's as the system's currently set up, I think we have a good way to ensure that we have a strong emphasis on the under 30, the smaller water diverters, which are probably because of costs and other reasons, are the ones that really need the cost share financial help rather than the much larger, for instance, irrigation districts, though they could always use the money too. But there are some other ways for them to receive funding as well. But I don't want to speak for Anita, who's also testifying here in a little bit. But anyway, we've worked hard to have a balance in the program between the under 30s and the over 30s, kind of the small and the large. And again, the public fish screening task force is one way that's helped us stay on balance.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions before we move on to the next panel? Thank you, gentlemen. And actually, with that, I will call Mr. Staples up. Brad Staples. And then I'm going to also ask Les Perkins and John Merwin if you could all come up, please, and sure and state your name for the record.
My name is Brad Staples. I make the majority of my living as a fishing guide on Lower Deschutes River, but I'm here as chairman of Fish Greening Task Force. And like Roy said, there's seven of us that are on the task force representing sport fishing interests and water users, agriculture and such. We advise the department on issues in regards to fish screens. We meet approximately four times a year. And I've seen a lot of good projects get installed through this program. This program's a winner for everyone that's involved. And, I hope you find it your best interest for agriculture, power, and the fish to support the bill the way it's written.
Thank you.
And is there any questions?
I'll see if there's any questions here. How long have you served on the task force?
I believe since 2002.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate you coming here. I know you came over 100 miles, so certainly appreciate that. And we have two other folks that came over 100 miles, so I'd like to ask them to come up, John Merwin and Les Perkins. Is Les here? Okay. And so John is with the Bagley Ditch Company. You can both come up. I want to make sure you get you up first since you came drove the furthest. So for the record, can you please state your name and your affiliation?
My name is Les Perkins. I come under a couple of hats. I'm a Hood River County Commissioner. I've been serving on the watershed group there in Hood River for a few years, actually about 6 years now. And so from that perspective, I'm familiar with what ODFW does with screening and fish passage. In our basin, it's been very successful. They put a lot of money into getting screens in the ground there. In 1996, there was a flood that wiped out most of the diversions in Hood River, and at that time, one of the irrigation districts thought they would like to try a different way of screening, and the only agency that really showed an interest in doing it differently was Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And with help from ODFW and eventually other agencies, the irrigation district designed and patented a horizontal fish screen. This is where I wear my second hat. I'm now the business development director for a nonprofit called Farmers Conservation Alliance, and we are doing screening in the state of Oregon using this patented fish screen. I've been doing this for a little over a year and been working very closely with ODF&W and they've been amazingly helpful. You come from the public sector and you think that agencies aren't helpful. ODFW's been extremely helpful. They have introduced us to irrigation districts that have screening projects. They've helped us through the funding process. Our goal as an organization is to address the 10 CFS and under screens, so we will be focusing most of our energy on finding funding for and implementing screening projects for individual landowners and irrigation districts. And this is something that Ray has been really helpful with in helping us identify exactly how we're going to go about doing this, getting us lined up with other agencies. So we will be out there as well with the support of ODFW, concentrating on those small diversions. We'll be doing large diversions as well, but focusing primarily on those small diversions.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. We really appreciate it, and we're always happy to hear good things when our agencies are doing good things. But I was just by your river yesterday, and the amount of sediment
Yes.
that has come down, and I know you guys had a really tough time this winter.
We lost a lot of diversions again this year, so we're going back in and going through the process again. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for letting me testify before you. My name is John Merwin. I'm here representing the Bagley Ditch Corporation, which is a nonprofit irrigation district in Lake County, Oregon. It's on the Chewaucan River. We just recently completed a $2.7 million rehabilitation project on the river, which involves removing a diversion, which is a fish blockage, moving it upstream about a mile to where we didn't need any blockages in the river. We had a natural diversion there, and building a fish screen that diverts 111 CFS. We hired an engineering firm to plan our whole project, including our screen. It was out of Boise, Idaho. And we had a lot of trouble getting our fish screen approved. We finally we got our design for our fish screen. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife emailed the plans to our engineers in Boise, and they tweaked them a little bit and probably charged us $100,000. So I just say that I think we have probably some of the best resources here in the state of Oregon with their engineering and their screening crews as anybody in the United States. They're fantastic. When we first started the screen project, we asked the Fish and Wildlife for a price if they build our screen. And they gave us a price, and the directors of the Bagley Ditch Corporation decided that was too high a price. So we put the screen out on bid. That decision cost us $50,000. By the time we got done with our change orders, if we would have had the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife do it, we would have saved $50,000. They would have had a more direct involvement in the screen. They would have been married to the screen more than us doing it ourselves. I'm not complaining about that because we got a good diversion and we agreed to maintain the screen forever. It was a trade-off. But in some cases where you're just screening and you have a perfectly functioning diversion and the screening is just for screening, then maybe the Fish and Wildlife should be more involved in it. They certainly are capable. One other point I want to make is that a lot of people, when you hear large screens or large diversions, they immediately think of a large irrigation district or something. Our screen of 111 CFS services over 60 different water right users, owners. Many of these have multiple water rights. Our normal flow through that screen is probably 60 CFS. And that means that we actually are dividing it up to one CFS per water right holder. So a lot of times these larger screens service a lot more of the population than what people think. And it makes sense to me to screen where you're at the head of that diversion rather than put in a whole bunch of small screens downriver. It makes sense. And I'll answer any questions. And I just want to reiterate that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and actually all the agencies on this project were fantastic to work with.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Okay. Great. Thank you, gentlemen. We really appreciate you coming all the way here today. Next, we're going to hear from Dennis Ritchie and Dave Moskowitz.
Dave, you want to go ahead first? I'll pass these.
Okay, I'll be very brief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here today on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon and the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. And we just, both organizations wish to express their support for House Bill 2294. And they've worked with the department and many of the other user groups for many years as this program has developed, and we're pleased to be able to support these refinements. And that's really all I have. I'm happy to take any questions.
Great.
And it's nice to be up here with Fanny Ritchie.
Thank you. Mr. Ritchie, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll see if there's any questions for both of you.
My name is Dennis Ritchie. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Anglers. And the main reason I'm here, I'm not an expert on fish screening at all, but I was on the Coastal Coho Recovery Team representing sports fishermen. I'm currently on the Upper Willamette Recovery Plan Team, and as of this week, I am now chair of the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Advisory Committee. And because of all these recovery plans that I work with, we feel very strongly that this is a positive step to be able to go forward with cost sharing on some of the larger fish screening projects. Also feel that it's positive clarifying that the charges for going out and inspecting and repairing some of the smaller screen situations, they've only been a $25 charge, I believe, up till now, and they're trying to establish a real cost charge. We feel very strongly that with water rights come water responsibilities, and when it comes to recovering fish, it's very important for all of us, especially the water users, to do their part. Thank you.
Great. Any questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Richard Kosasan and Jim Welsh. You want to come up, please?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. My name, for the record, is Richard Kosasan, and I'm here today with Water for Life. And for purposes of background, Water for Life was instrumental in the development of this legislation in 1991. But for reflection, the legislation really truly reaches back to 1987. And the debate came up on the screening or the installation of bypass devices on all diversions. And some legislation was passed towards the end of the 87 session, which mandated the screening of all diversions, irrespective of size. In 1989, the legislature revisited the issue and came back and said maybe that was a little bit overzealous, placed a two-year moratorium on that requirement, directed the Department of Fish and Wildlife to take a look at diversions throughout the state and develop a priority list of diversions which should be screened. And in 91, Dave McTeague's office was instrumental in truly the development of the program that we have today. It was always envisioned to be a cost-share program. I think there was a great emphasis on landowner involvement. There was a great emphasis on cost share provisions contained in the program. But with that, I would like to raise a couple of concerns with the bill as drafted. I previously noted, and I tend to agree with Mr. Ellicker, in terms of a program, I think this program has been met with a great deal of success, both from the state level as well as landowner participation, landowner acceptance and buy-in. You could reach back to 91, and I think the allocations, it was then envisioned to be a cost-share program, basically funded a third by fishermen with a surcharge on angling fees, third from landowners, and a third from the general fund, In 91, I think the program, the 91-93 biennium, the allocation was less than $1 million. So the program has substantially taken off since that period of time. To the bill, Madam Chair, I think Water for Life would like to encourage some consideration be given to provisions contained in Section 1, Line 30, Page 1. The cost-sharing program funds may not be provided under this subsection for screening or bypass devices on a water diversion involving water rights issued on or after July 1, 1991. And to me, it would appear prudent that if we have a diversion that accessed a permit in 92, 93, 94, for example, that could participate in this program, they should be able to participate in the program. We would also encourage some consideration to the modification in language in subsection 4, starting on line 7. A fee may be assessed against a responsible party in an amount that does not exceed $5,000 or 40% of the construction and installation costs. And the $5,000 cap was eliminated. That $5,000 cap was included in the original language in 1991. Again, subsection 6, starting at line 17, it appears that the language contained there may conflict with language contained in section 9, subsection D, starting on page 3, line 6, sub D. When we delete the language specifically on line 7, minor maintenance, in respect to that same subsection, we delete the language that the department is authorized to assess a fee not to exceed $25. And we have moved to a standard of allowing the department to charge, quote, the actual cost for each required visit to the location of the screening or bypass device. And if you look at rural areas of this state in terms of where they may be located, landowners might be frightened by an unexpected bill that could, I think, be very, very substantial. We would like to see if we could bring some clarity to that issue. Finally, our concern really through the past 10, 12, 14-year period has been the split in terms of allocation of dollars towards large diversions, those being historically it has been a split of under 30 cubic feet per second and over 30 CFS. If we begin to put all the eggs in one basket and identify one or two or three very large, substantial diversions to be screened, to me, all the dollars could be taken by those diversions, and then we lose our emphasis on the small diversions. I think language could be easily incorporated here to hit a balance between those two, and I do appreciate Mr. Ellicker's previous comments that I think he indicated that since 1999, 70% of the dollars have been basically focused on the small diversions. But again, that is from a historical background. The emphasis of the program was on the small diversions. If you were to reach back and take a look at the original priority listing developed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, surprisingly, their priority listing showed that the vast majority of diversions were relatively small, and relatively small being one CFS or even less. And that was a great number of that first list, and I think that first list was 3 to 3,500 diversions. With that, Madam Chair, we would welcome a chance to work with the department to address a couple of these issues, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me hear from Mr. Welsh first, and then we'll go to questions. Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, I am Jim Welsh, representing Oregon Cattlemen's Association. this has been a very successful cost-sharing program, and our concern is that it stay that way, representing certainly a lot of small diversion projects for a lot of our producers. And we are certainly concerned about the small versus large, as Richard was talking about this, for the same reasons we have these concerns, and we're not sure the changes here, and certainly we appreciate the success of the program and Deputy Director Elliker's comments that wasn't intended in the language of this bill to make the changes that we possibly are concerned or fearful of here. The actual cost to the landowners when this has been a cost-sharing program, those changes for small diversions could be significant, as we know. And then the large diversions, taking maybe more of the a preference for the future and reducing the possible emphasis on the smaller diversions is definitely a concern. If there's some way we can work out some details on this before you pass this out, we'd certainly appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for this panel, these panel members? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Appreciate it.
And last, we have up Anita Winkler with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. It's the last person that we have signed up to testify, so if there's anybody else that would like to testify, please feel free to come forward at this time.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. The Congress represents, we're the trade association that represents irrigation districts, water control districts, improvement districts, and other basically public entities that deliver irrigation water throughout Oregon. You have been delivered to you some written testimony. I'm not going to read all that testimony. You can have it for the record. I'm here in support of this bill. We appreciate the department's effort to open this program to some larger diversions. I thought probably more of interest to you is what am I talking about when I talk about a larger diversion? I can't give you the CFS. I'd have to canvass every one of our members, and most of them have multiple diversions, so the size varies considerably. But the cost of fish screening I thought might be particularly of interest. I know of one of the smaller of the large diversions. The total cost of a fish screen project there was $50,000. At the other extreme is the fish screen that was built for Klamath several years ago. That was over $16 million. Mr. Elliker referred to the Santa Ana Water Control District fish screen just east of here. That one was just over $2 million. It's a very large diversion. Others are more typically in the $750,000 to $900,000 range. They are very large. They are very expensive. We recognize, and in fact we talked with people when this idea first came up, that we don't want to dominate this program. We could eat up every penny that's in there. That's not our intent. That certainly doesn't serve Oregon very well. The department did put a cap of, I believe, $75,000 on any one project. I don't have the records of what the districts would have looked for, but we typically patch together a rather complicated array of different funding sources, ranging from OWEB money to something called the Fishery Restoration and Irrigation Mitigation Act. It's a big federal program that we worked that legislation several years ago to get funding for fish screens. The private money from other members in the district, and then the district's money. And while the districts are public, I would remind you that that is the landowner's money. They pay the district for their water, and it's that money that then is diverted into fish screen projects. So I'm here in support of the bill, and I'm here to answer any other questions you may have.
Thank you, Anita. Any questions? Okay. Representative Jensen, I believe, has a question.
I'm not real sure, but I glance at your testimony and read your support. Are you in support of the district cost of $15 million? What am I missing in here?
No, we're Chair Dingfelder and Representative Jensen, we're supporting this bill. What I wanted to explain is that these projects cost as much as $15 million or more to construct. I'm not sure that I support one that costs that much, but the fact of the matter is that that's what that project cost. It was a federal project.
I understand that.
You have a follow-up?
I'm just looking for, you know, where you're at in relationship to the costs that are going to be involved in this. And obviously the districts you represent then are the ones that are going to be responsible for the costs or some of the costs. And is that wide open as far as your district are concerned, whatever we want to pass on?
Chair Dingfelder and Representative Jensen, we're supporting the bill as written, and as I understand it, it's a $75,000 per project cap. In all honesty, I don't think most of our districts would apply for all of that money because they're already putting together this wide range of funding sources, and it would range, I would guess, and I'm really hypothetical at this point, probably more in the $25,000 to $50,000 that they'd look for from this source of money for any one project.
Okay.
Does that help?
Thank you for that clarification. Great, thank you. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Okay, I think Representative Smith has a question.
At some point in time, I don't know if it'd be possible. I had another question for Roy based upon testimony from Mr. Co.
Costasan? Mm-hmm. Roy, you want to come back up?
For the record, Roy Elliker, Deputy Director, Oregon Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah. Good seeing you, Roy. Richard made a statement, and I apologize, this issue is new to me and I don't know the particulars of it, but he alluded to a comment about the open-endedness of a fee that could be charged to the landowner for folks to come out and to do work with them. And all I keep thinking about is someone from ODF&W leaving Salem and 9.5 hours later arriving in Troy, Oregon. And I'm trying to figure out how do we protect the landowner from an open-ended bill that could be much, much greater than they would have ever anticipated? And if I'm missing something here, I don't know, Richard, if you could come up and elaborate. And because isn't it based upon the expense to the department?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Greg Smith, I'm going to ask Ray Hardrow to kind of respond to that question. He's the program manager.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, and maybe I could go back and talk a little bit about what the whole purpose of this is. Mm-hmm. This is something that we hope we never have to use, really. Right now, we're allowed to charge $25 to go out and provide the minor maintenance that the landowner is supposed to do. There's only been a few cases that we know of where the minor maintenance has been so poor that where it's actually caused major destruction of the screen. It plugs up, the water cuts around it, and we end up, because we're responsible for the major maintenance, you know, having to go out and replace a screen.
So can I interrupt
real quick
there? And just so I'm clear, so this is a landowner who was negligent in maintaining the agreement of some type of contractual agreement between the state
That's correct.
And themselves. Mm-hmm.
And Chair Smith, yes, they're responsible for the minor maintenance under the agreement, the grant agreements that we sign with them to provide the cost share funding. And so this is the only intent here is to get to make those landowners aware that where that are not providing the maintenance. And by far, most landowners, it's not an issue. They want to get their water. They keep the screen clean, and under minor maintenance, that's what's involved, cleaning the screen, greasing the components, that sort of thing. This is only kind of a stick to have in the toolbox if that's not going to be done to protect the state's investment of the screen.
So if you don't want to follow this, if you don't want to foot the bill, do your job. You're a part of the agreement.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the clarification. I think Representative Jensen, did this evoke another question?
Same follow-up on it.
Mm-hmm.
The word minor has been struck from the bill in terms of minor maintenance cost.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, I see that, and I think that was an effort because we're taking several statutes that have deal with the under 30s, the over 30s, and consolidating them. But that is really all we're after because projects over 30 CFS those individuals are required to provide all maintenance. Really, it's primarily the smaller projects under 30 CFS where the maintenance is not being done. And again, I can only think in, you know, since the cost share program started, only two or three instances where that's really become a serious problem. But we never did charge anybody the $25 because, frankly, it cost us more to build the $25 than, to do the work. So.
Okay. I think Representative Smith has another question.
Thank you. I just want to flush through this issue.
Mm-hmm. No pun intended.
No
there.
Pun intended. Yeah. How do you collect the? How do you anticipate collecting this if you have to exercise this right? You send them the bill. What if they don't pay? If they're negligent and not taking care of the minor repairs, how do you handle it if they don't pay the bill? And then what do you do?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you bring up a good point. It's one of the reasons where I don't think in the history of the program we've never tried to do the $25 thing. And here's the way it works, though, especially with the smaller under 30s. So they sign a contractual agreement. They're going to put up 40% of the money. We put up 60%. We're going to build a screen. And then they're going to make sure the screen is kept clean and lubricated. Because what happens if there's a blowout, let's say there's flood, lose the whole screen. The state is responsible to replace the fish screen under current legislation.
100%. So the land. Correct.
What's that?
It's 100%
yes,
replacement.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. I mean, the state's always been responsible for what's called the major maintenance. So this $25 provision was put into effect out of the 91 legislation, or maybe before, as Mr. Kosan pointed out, again with the thought that at some point, if a landowner doesn't clean the screen, lubricate it, just generally keep, you know, what happens sooner or later, it gets all clogged up, can blow out, and then the state has to come in and replace the whole screen at 100%. So that's the genesis of the $25 provision. But you bring up a good point. One of the issues is if the landowner is not doing maintenance and if you're going to send him a bill and he's not going to pay, what are you going to do? In the end, probably what we would do is just pull the whole screen out of there. But then at some point, especially if fish are federally listed, well, at some point, the feds might come and talk. And this has happened down, particularly in southwestern Oregon, under some rules that the NOAA fisheries passed about fish screening. They actually were federal rules that you have to have screen diversions. That did happen in one area of the state. And that's an example where, in the end, if the state and the landowner can't really work out their issues, the state's probably going to end up pulling the screen out of there, and then he can deal with whatever issues come out of that. But we've never had an issue like that, Representative. Really not.
No, if you're a landowner, it'd be...
Makes no sense.
Yeah,
right?
It doesn't make sense.
No.
Just one last quick question. Property exchanges hands. Is it placed into a deed of trust? How do you get a future landowner, a new landowner of the property, to understand the agreement? Does the department have a method of contacting me, the new landowner of a ranch, and saying?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. What commonly happens is, say, and this has happened quite a bit, say down southwest Oregon, where we have a large number of small water diverters in the rogue system, and we've had to actually build new systems down there with new landowners. So when land changes hands, we become aware of that. We'll actually have a fish screening person go out and meet with the new landowner. If he has questions about how these things work, if he has questions about what his contractual obligation is, I mean, because in a sense, he has quite an investment that device worked properly, so he gets his water. I mean, that's the kind of the self-appreciating part of this, is the landowners, they want their water, and they know if they keep their screens clean and work with us, they're not going to worry about fish protection, and they're going to get their water in an appropriate way. And so that's why, I mean, out of hundreds of fish screens, even the ones that we've had some just disagreements, very rare in the program. Once they buy into the program, see what we're doing for them, what they're getting out of it, that really, it sells itself, Representative. That's why it's been so successful.
Great job.
And I do want to also comment, if could, that from the Fish Screening Task Force side, where we have some agricultural representatives on there, there are many times that Water for Life and other Water Congress and other groups, watershed councils, talk to landowners as well, letting landowners know about the program. I mean, the program would not be successful without the really good, strong support of the ag community in particular. And that's been there all along in the program.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Any other questions? Okay. Well, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2294. And that's all the bills we have today, so we will close the House Energy and Environment Committee. We'll see